Dr. Sean Carroll is my guest, and he's obviously a heavyweight in the world of physics. He is a senior research associate in physics at the California Institute of Technology. His research involving theoretical physics and astrophysics, focusing on issues in cosmology, field theory, and gravitation, all the things that would be involved, possibly, in time travel. In a moment, we'll talk to him about, we'll find out how much of an optimist or a pessimist he really is for all of mankind. There are some positive signs, but there are an awful lot of negative signs out there right now for us. So in a moment, we'll probe that area. Once again, Dr. Sean Carroll. Dr. Carroll, I interviewed a number of theoretical physicists, and one of them, Dr. Michio Kaku, feels that, well, he does a kind of a Star Trek explanation for where we are in the world with a Type 0 planet, Type 1, Type 2, Type 3, Type 3 being able to control the power of suns, and, you know, that's a long, 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 long way away. But he said we're a Type 0 on the verge of becoming a Type 1. And when you really pin him down and ask him whether he feels we can survive the discovery and development of Element 92, he really says no. Our chances of moving on ahead are just tiny. And I wonder if you feel the same pessimism.
Well, I think this is one of those things where literally everyone is entitled to their opinion, since we have no information whatsoever. We have no data about what happens to a civilization when it gets to our point in development. But physicists, if you're thinking that they seem pessimistic, are probably so because they've all heard of the Fermi paradox. The basic problem that if a civilization does last for a while, it doesn't take it that long, astronomically speaking, for it to fill the entire galaxy. And it wouldn't be hard for humanity to have noticed other civilizations back when we first started pointing radio telescopes at the rest of the galaxy. But they're not there. There's no civilizations out there, even though they should be very easy to spot.
Very troubling.
It's very troubling, and it might be this. Two very, very obvious explanations. One is that, despite what you might think, it's very hard for life ever to develop. Even though there's lots of planets, that maybe that the particular set of things that led to the first microbe here on Earth were just less likely than you think, and that we are, in fact, unique, at least as far as our own galaxy is concerned.
Life is rare.
Yeah.
That's certainly possible. Do you buy into that one?
I have no idea. I'm, you know, no one generally accuses theoretical cosmologists of humility, but on that one I'm going to be humble. I think that I have no idea.
Okay.
And the other possibility is that life happens all the time and civilizations develop and they destroy themselves. Also very possible. Once we get to be powerful in a certain sense of the word, we turn on all sorts of ways to destroy our own planet that we didn't have back when we were hunters and gatherers. I think that global warming and global climate change is something that is potentially disastrous, that we don't know what's going on, and who knows? It could, you know, 100 years from now, 200 years from now, make things really sort of disastrously bad for us.
Oh, yes.
So
Have you looked at the North Pole? I mean, my God, if you look at pictures of the North Pole 40 years ago, pictures today, if it doesn't scare you, then you're just not an observer. I mean, 40, 50% of it is just gone. We're going to be navigating ships where the ice used to be, and the a Ross ice shelf down south may be getting unstable. I read stories about all the fish in the ocean being dead by 2048. These are stories that are really, really scary, and they're not science fiction. They're real, and it all seems to be speeding up. So even if we don't blow ourselves up, it seems entirely possible that we'll simply make it unlivable.
It is possible, yeah. And again, I want to stress that I don't know, but I can look at the graphs of the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere as a function of time, and you see it sort of jiggling along very, very, you know, it goes up and down, but there's a central value that it doesn't ever stray very far from until the last 50 years, where it's gone zoom, way up there. And you can say, and there are people who say, well, we don't know whether that's good or bad. What will happen? And that's true. And, you know, it's also true that if you take a giant needle with some unknown chemical in it and stick it into your brain, it might make you smarter. You never know. But you wouldn't want to do that experiment if you didn't actually know what was going to happen. You should be careful a little bit and a little conservative to allow the conditions under which you know you can exist to continue on for a little bit.
Yes.
So I know that, you know, I know physicist friends who are very highly trained about this, and even though what they really want to do is to tell NASA to help them build their favorite satellite or whatever, they're saying, you know, hello, guys, you really should be paying attention to what's happening to the Earth, because that's what everyone will be talking about and nothing else 50 years from now.
Well, with what we know about physics, if we screw up the Earth, there are many who say that we had better figure out a way to colonize other planets if we wish mankind to continue. But, gee, with what we know about physics, you know, the nearby planets we have in our system, they don't seem all that particularly hospitable at the moment, unless we're able to somehow terraform them. And getting to another star system, well, that just doesn't seem possible with these damn laws of physics.
Yeah, I think that if you're thinking about what can go on, if you're thinking about what might happen if we destroy the Earth, it depends on what you mean by destroying the Earth. If we really do have some sort of nuclear war, I personally don't think that would destroy the Earth and kill all the human beings. It would be a terrible disaster and a cataclysm, but humanity would probably survive. And if you're talking about global climate change, then it's a different thing, but it still remains true that living in Antarctica or living in the bottom of the ocean is a more hospitable environment than living on the moon or living on Mars. So it's nice to contemplate visiting other planets and colonizing them, but it's not a practical suggestion in terms of extending our lifespan in the foreseeable future.
No. And since the closer in planets are not hospitable, what I said about getting to another star system is sadly true, isn't it? In other words,
well, it takes a long time. It's not that you can't do it. To get to the nearest star requires 4 years if you travel very close to the speed of light. So
which
we can't right now, but that's an engineering problem. Someday we will be able to build rockets or the successors of rockets that can go close to the speed of light. The laws of physics say nothing about that. They allow you to do that, so someday we will, unless we kill ourselves first. So
we could, without biological difficulty for man, we could travel close to the speed of light. There's no law that says we would begin to get sick or something awful would happen to us as we approach the speed of light?
That's right. Yeah, no law against that at all. In fact, if we don't kill ourselves, if humanity lasts another 10,000 years, I'd be much more surprised if we hadn't sent spaceships to other star systems than if we had.
So then if life is fairly common, which, you know, in my way of thinking, when you look up at the night sky and see all those stars and, you know, we've now discovered lots of planets around stars, the bigger ones anyway, so you can imagine the small ones must be there. There must be other fairly habitable planets out there, and yet SETI looks and looks, and no signals yet. No hint of anybody anywhere yet. That's very, very concerning.
Well, I don't know if it's concerning or not, but it's certainly true, and it's information. It's giving us a little bit of data when we try to answer this question, how common is both life and advanced civilized life on other planets. And the thing is that there are a large number, very, very probably there are a very large number of star systems with planets in the observable universe, and probably most of them don't have life on them. So if you want to know the total number that do, you have to take the very large number of planets and multiply them by the very small number, which is the percentage that have some sort of life, and the answer is we have no idea what the answer to that is right now.
Well, except that we have no hard evidence that we've been visited. We certainly have no evidence that we've received a signal yet,
despite
our best efforts.
That's right.
Should we be working harder at that, in your opinion? We have, SETI is now basically only a privately funded effort. Should it be getting a lot more attention, be receiving more funds?
Well, I think actually it gets about the right amount. I'm not an expert, so I don't know exactly how many it gets, but it's a very high-risk, very high-gain sort of proposition. Very high-risk in the sense that the chances per year that you're going to succeed and find something are very, very small, but obviously the consequences of finding something would be tremendous. So it's absolutely worth doing, but it's not worth making a priority when there's plenty of other things we could be doing whose payoff is a little bit more tangible and guaranteed.
Do you think that where the Earth is headed right now with global warming can be turned around? I'm beginning to hear some scientists suggest that it's already too late, that even if we were to begin turning things around now, which seems improbable, that is to say that we could do it, as you look around the world, the U.S. has certainly taken some steps, but gosh, I'm here in Southeast Asia, and I can tell you what's going on in China would just scare the tar out of you in terms of what's being put into the air, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I have no idea whether or not we can reverse it, but that question is a tiny bit academic since we're not trying very hard to even slow it down, much less reverse it.
Right.
So my focus personally, and again, this is not my area of expertise, but as a human being and a citizen, my focus is taking seriously the fact that we can't just keep dumping pollutants into the air without any regard for the consequences. So cutting down on carbon dioxide emissions is the first step. Forgetting about whether or not we can fix it, we should stop, shocking the system that we don't understand so dramatically.
Indeed. All right. Maybe you can. You seem to be very good at this, so let's try with dark matter. I still do not properly understand at all what dark matter is and dark energy. I really don't understand what they are.
Oh, that's easy.
It is?
Yeah, it's, the simple version of dark matter is just matter. Particles, just like atoms make up you and me, there's some other kind of particle, something that is not a proton or a neutron or electron or any other kind of particle we've ever seen in the lab, but there's some kind of particle that has a mass, and there are a lot of them out there in the universe. And the thing about these particles, these dark matter particles, is that they don't bump into ordinary particles directly. If you had dark matter particles going through your body right now, you would never know, because you probably do have those dark matter particles going through your body, and you don't know. However, the accumulated effect of all these particles gives rise to gravity. One of the things that Einstein told us was that anything that has mass creates a gravitational field.
Right.
And so even though these particles don't bump into our detectors directly, we can measure the total gravitational fields in different parts of the universe, and we can look at the ordinary matter, the stuff we know is there, and say what gravitational field would that produce. And over and over and over again, it falls dramatically short.
So there's gravity coming from somewhere that we don't understand.
That's
And that leads us to say, well, it has to be dark matter, this stuff we call dark matter. I don't understand if it has mass in a way we can measure because of the gravity, then how can it not bump into conventional matter?
Well, we hope that someday it will. We hope that its interactions with conventional matter are just very, very weak, and therefore we haven't been able to detect it yet. For a long time, that was the status of the neutrino. The neutrino was a little particle that was predicted by particle physicists in the 50s, or maybe even before the 50s, actually. Yeah, before the 50s. With the annoying property that you couldn't detect it. But it existed, and it had mass, maybe, maybe not, maybe it was massless, but it had certain properties we understood very well, And we thought about it and built better experiments, and eventually we detected them. And now we know that the sun is spewing out neutrinos, and neutrinos are passing through our bodies all the time. And we detect them every day. There's neutrino experiments going on.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just saying the same kind of thing would be true with more particles that we haven't yet detected. I mean, at some level, we need to be a tiny bit humble. There's no reason why the particles that are easiest for us to see should be most of the stuff in the universe.
Okay, but it's still hard to understand why those we can see don't interact in any way, apparently, with those that we can't see.
Well, again, it could be very much like neutrinos. And what I mean very much like, I mean, we have very successful models of how particle physics works. And there's this famous statement that there are four forces of nature: the gravitational force, the electromagnetic force, the weak nuclear force, and the strong nuclear force. And of those four, the strong nuclear force and the electromagnetic force are just bloody obvious. It's very easy to see things that interact in that way. And almost every particle that we know interacts either through the strong nuclear force or through the electromagnetic force. The only counterexample is the neutrino. And it's been very, very hard to see. It only interacts through gravity and through the weak nuclear force. So if you had another particle that was heavier than the neutrino, but also only interacted through gravity and the weak nuclear force, it would be a perfect dark matter candidate. And it's very, very plausible. It's just not a very big extrapolation from known physics. Unlike dark energy, by the way, dark energy is a separate category, which is a bit more mind-bending. But dark matter is really just one more heavy particle we haven't quite detected yet, even though it could be very much like particles we already have.
All right, where does dark energy come from, if not dark matter?
Well, dark matter was inferred from looking at what galaxies and clusters of galaxies do. They move around each other, they deflect light, they grow as the universe expands. And every single thing about them tells us that the total mass of a galaxy or cluster of galaxies is dominated by dark matter, not by ordinary matter. But more recently, we've been able to go beyond looking at galaxies and clusters to looking at the whole universe all at once, both sort of weighing the whole universe, determining the entire amount of energy in it, and also looking at its evolution through time, looking how it expands and how the expansion rate changes.
Right.
And what we've realized is that in order to fit those new data, there must be stuff that is in between the galaxies and clusters. There must be stuff that is smoothly spread throughout the universe. So there's a lot more density at the center of the Earth than in the middle of interstellar space, and there's even a lot more density of dark matter in the solar system than there is far outside the galaxy. But dark energy is something that has the same density everywhere, the same amount for every cubic centimeter, whether it's right here in the room or very far away in between the galaxies.
Okay, so then dark matter does not have an equal distribution.
No, just like ordinary matter, there's a bunch of dark matter where there's a galaxy, and there's much less of it when you're far outside a galaxy.
On the other hand, dark energy is equally present everywhere.
That's what we think, yes.
Huh.
And
are these
better,
the forces?
Yeah, okay. It's the same density as a function of time as well. As the universe expands, ordinary matter dilutes away, right? Just as if you take a balloon and expand it, the density inside goes down because you're creating more volume.
Right.
But as you expand the universe, while the dark matter dilutes away and the ordinary matter dilutes away, the dark energy persists. So the amount of dark energy in every cubic centimeter of the universe doesn't grow or shrink as the universe expands. So it's really the same everywhere in space and the same everywhere in time. And that's a dramatic idea, but you come up with that one idea. You just say, okay, maybe there's something that's the same everywhere throughout space and time, and it fits a multiple set of observations. So there's really no wriggling out of it by now.
Hmm. And everything is moving away from everything else, so that eventually, someday in the far distant future, we will look into the sky and we will see virtually nothing but blackness, yes?
That's the idea, yes. That's exactly
right.
That's
very depressing, very depressing.
Fade away, get more red and cold.
More red and more and colder. All right, Dr. Carroll, hold it right there. Dr. Sean Carroll is my guest. Eventually, the night sky will no longer be star-studded. I'm Art Bell. Very fascinating. Dr. Sean Carroll is my guest. And I think in a moment we'll ask him about the Big Bang. Is that really how it happened? That incomprehensible moment when something smaller than a quark, which I don't think we've still properly identified, became all that is. It seems so totally unreasonable to me. Dr. Carroll, back in a moment. I guess the current belief about the age of our universe is around 14 billion years or something like that, and still expanding it. It seems to get revised every now and then as yet another bright, no doubt, quickly rotating object in space is located. They add another billion years or so to how old the universe is. But at the beginning of it all, there was apparently this Big Bang. This moment when something so small that we can barely think about it became all that is. Doctor, is there any way that, I guess, first of all, you do believe in the Big Bang scenario, right?
I do, yeah. I'm a big fan.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Big fan. How is there any way you can explain to me how something that small, smaller than a quark, right?
Well, this is exactly the question. I mean, the physicists use the term Big Bang to refer to two slightly different things. One is, like you said, the Big Bang scenario, which says that the universe is expanding from an initially extremely hot, dense state into the large, dilute, cool state that we're in right now. And that scenario has been tested seven ways from Sunday and is very firmly established. But then they also use the phrase Big Bang to refer to the moment at T equals zero, when the classical theory that we have predicts that there's a singularity. That in fact,
now,
it's not
T meaning time?
Time equals zero, the beginning of everything,
okay.
Yes.
All right.
Not just smaller than a quark, but literally zero size is the prediction. But the point is that nobody believes that. The point is that that is a point where the theory that we believe right now predicts that the theory itself makes no sense. So everyone knows that we don't know exactly what happens at that moment. It could be that somehow the universe came into existence. It could be that there was a pre-existing stage of the universe's history out of which our purported Big Bang arose, and we strictly have no idea.
Could what we call the Big Bang, and we imagine to be something coming from nothing, could it, for example, be the collision of two black holes?
Yes, it could be. That would require that there is some pre-existing space and time.
Right.
And in that space and time, something happened. Maybe two black holes colliding. I'm not a big fan of two black holes colliding, but there are other things that could happen in a pre-existing space-time that would cause what we call a baby universe to form. A little bubble of stuff could appear in space and time and pinch off and grow into its own universe. And that's completely in play in terms of scenarios for what happened at or before the beginning of what we perceive as our universe.
It's an awful lot easier to believe that than it is to believe that something that had no mass became all the mass.
Yeah, you have to be a little bit careful because on the one hand, the universe doesn't care what we find easy to believe or hard to believe. It just doesn't obey the laws of physics. But on the other hand, our laws of physics break down at that point. So it's perfectly okay to use our intuitions about what makes sense and what doesn't make sense to sort of make up plausible scenarios and then see if you can build them into respectable theories. We haven't done it yet, but it's an absolutely it's something that people are very actively trying to do at the cutting edge of cosmological research right
now. Is there any area of research in your field that is closing in on what exactly did happen?
Well, closing in is a little bit of an optimistic way of putting it, because we don't know whether we're closing in until we've closed in. There is absolutely a set of people, and I'm one of them, who are writing papers about what could plausibly have happened before the Big Bang. Where could the Big Bang have come from?
And well, other than the collision of two black holes, what do you imagine?
Well, I imagine that there are quantum fluctuations. You know, quantum mechanics says that you can't pin things down to perfectly predictable states, and that includes space and time itself. So even in our universe right now, even as we are expanding and our universe is emptying out, there is dark energy, right? We believe that there is dark energy, which means even empty space has energy, and the universe will always keep expanding. It will never completely stop.
Right.
And that means that space and time in the far future of the universe are always going to be jiggling a little bit, always going to be fluctuating. And we could get lucky, and a fluctuation happens in just the right way to pop out a new baby universe from that pre-existing empty space.
Well, from our perspective, would that really be lucky or catastrophic?
It wouldn't be so bad from our perspective, because from the outside perspective, what we would see is the formation of a tiny black hole, which would then soon evaporate away. But if we were to go into that black hole before it evaporated away and do some quantum mechanical magic, we would come out the other side into a brand new baby universe. These are all things that we're allowed to speculate about, not at all anything that well-understood theories predict, but these are things that are, like I said, on the table for what could possibly be going on. So cosmologists get in a little bit of trouble because we have a really good theory. We have Einstein's general theory of relativity that describes what we observe in the universe right now to exquisite precision. And it's really good. We like this theory. It predicts, you know, it explains the whole Big Bang that we know and love up to that point at the very beginning where it breaks down. And if the theory were right perfectly, then the universe would have a singularity at the beginning, and that would be the moment when everything began. Time and space came into existence. But the theory is not right at that point. As much as we know and love the theory today, when the curvature of space-time becomes infinitely large, the theory is not right, and there's no reason to think it is. So we have to be open-minded.
And does that open-mindedness include the possibility of intelligent creation?
It includes the possibility, but as far as theories go, that's not most people's favorite theory, no. It doesn't help with anything. I mean, our universe seems to just be following rules, and it seems much more satisfying to a scientist to find rules that it obeys all the way through, even before the Big Bang.
Can we ever know anything about can we actually get to before the Big Bang? Is it doable?
Well, strictly speaking, I have to say I don't know, since we haven't come up with a theory yet. I would not be surprised if the answer is no. I hope that's not too many negatives. It's very possible that we can never get direct experimental evidence of what happened before the Big Bang. But what is possible is that we could have a theory that, on the one hand, made testable predictions, and we tested those theories really, really well, and tested those predictions really, really well, and at the same time, that theory told us unambiguously what happened before the Big Bang. That's what you have to aim for. We're not there yet. We're not going to get there in the next 2 years, but this was my prediction for what the big breakthrough would be in the next 50 years in cosmology, that 50 years from now, we would understand the Big Bang.
So we could be then, what we call the Big Bang, could be the creation of a new bubble, a new universe. It could be that moment.
That's right. It could be nothing special in the whole history of the universe. There could be little bangs going on all over the place. It almost makes more sense, but I try not to care what makes more sense or not. I just try to follow what the theories are telling us could happen.
There are those who believe that if we found a way to travel in time, if we went back into time and did something that was a violation, you know, killing dad or killing grandfather, whatever, that at that instant, you would not cease to exist. You would continue to exist, but there would be a new bubble created, a new universe in which matters would unfold in a very different manner, different way.
Yeah, this is one of those things that it's hard to speculate about, even in an informed way, because we don't understand the complete set of laws of physics that would allow us to travel backwards in time. So it's like saying, if 2 plus 2 equaled 5, then what would 7 plus 8 equal?
Yes, it's just another way out of a paradox, though, a more modern way of explaining how you might get away from a paradox.
It's a way, that's right. So there's different ways. One way to avoid those paradoxes is that time travel is not possible. That's the simplest way and the sort of the most likely one. Another one is that you can travel back in time, but you cannot change anything. This is also, you know, quite sensible, that even though you think that you, if you were back there, you could do whatever you want, you still need to obey the laws of physics, and your past has already happened, and it's been determined. You can't change anything. Like you say, then there are more dramatic possibilities. One is that quantum mechanics becomes involved, and there's a different branch of the wave function, a different sort of quantum mechanical universe branches off. And that's, now we're talking about stuff that is fun to think about, but really is completely unmoored from physics that we already understand.
Sure, way out there.
So it's just hard to make any sensible judgment about how likely it is.
What about other dimensions? Are you a believer in up to 11 dimensions?
I am. I think that extra dimensions that we haven't yet observed make perfect sense and are even sort of pointed toward by some of our favorite physics theories that we have right now. But people get a little bit the wrong impression when we start talking about other dimensions. It's not like another plane of existence or even another parallel realm. We're talking about dimensions just like we talk about the three dimensions of space here inside a room. If you're a piece of paper, if you live on a piece of paper and could never leave, you would think that space was two-dimensional. Mm-hmm. Here in this room, we think it's three-dimensional. We're talking now about a hypothetical universe where space would be four or five or six or ten-dimensional. And that universe could be ours if those extra dimensions exist but are curled up to be so tiny that we can't perceive them. And I think that's very plausible. That's one of the things that we're trying to test experimentally right now.
And so you would not expect to find, as you mentioned, any sort of parallel universe where there's a whole different set of things going on in the same space?
Not in the same space. It is quite plausible that very, very far away, in a place that would seem like a different universe, but it's really just our universe, just far outside what we can perceive right now, conditions are very different. Even what we think of as the laws of physics are very different. You know, the charges and masses of all the elementary particles are different. There could be a region of our universe very far away where space looks six-dimensional instead of looking three-dimensional. These are things that actually are not that far out in terms of the state of the art of fundamental physics. We can talk sensibly about those things. We don't know if they're right or wrong, but they fit comfortably within a framework that we think is plausible.
You don't think dark energy could be mixed up with another universe, do you? And that would be the reason that we cannot reasonably measure it.
Well, we can reasonably measure it. We can't detect it except through its gravitational effect. But its gravitational effect is quite detectable, and we've measured how much
there
is.
So, yes. But we really can't detect dark energy as such. It's kind of like we're detecting the fact that something's there, but we can't detect that something directly. We're just detecting the effect of it.
That is right. But we could say, you know, if someone asks you how much dark energy there is, you can say there is 1/100th of a millionth of an erg in every cubic centimeter. That's a fact that we know about the universe if our theories are on the right track. And the existence of extra dimensions of space curled up very tiny so that we can't see them is one of the things that feeds into that number. So the existence of extra dimensions might play a very crucial role in determining why the dark energy has the size that it does.
Uh-huh.
That's something that people are taking very seriously. But what we would like is a formula. What we would like is a prediction that says, given what we know about the other laws of physics, here's how big the dark energy should be. we don't have that, or let me put it more accurately, the best formulas that we have along those lines give us answers that are wildly off from the number you actually observe. So this is a big puzzle that we're trying to understand. But we like puzzles because that means there's something we don't understand, and it's a clue towards a better theory that we don't yet have.
Are we closing in, a bad phrase again, on this theory of everything, this little formula that will eventually explain virtually everything? Is there going to be such a thing?
Well, you never know. And throughout human history, people have made fools of themselves by saying, oh, yes, we'll just dot a few I's and cross a few T's and we'll have it all figured out. Very, very smart people, for that matter. And I should say that on the one hand, we do have a unique situation in fundamental physics, that we have a theory that is almost a theory of everything, namely the standard model of particle physics plus general relativity. These two theories together, up until a few years ago, explained perfectly every piece of data that we had about what was going on in the universe. Since then, there have been chinks in the armor with things like dark matter and dark energy, hints that there's something beyond the standard model of particle physics, and therefore, but that was perfectly expected. No one ever expected the standard model to be the final answer. But I guess the lesson here is that if someone did come up with a theory tomorrow or 5 years from now that did accord both with general relativity, where gravity is concerned, and with the standard model of particle physics, where all the other forces and particles were concerned, it would not be completely crazy. It would not shake our foundations. We think that we have a pretty good grasp of what's going on. That would just complete the story. On the other hand, we could do an experiment at CERN next year that is completely divergent from that kind of understanding. We realize, oh my goodness, there's a whole realm out there that we haven't yet even begun to probe. So I'm very agnostic about whether or not you're close to the theory of everything. It's like asking whether or not the Russian dolls, as you open them, is this going to be the last one or not? Until you open it, you don't know.
And by the way, are you upset that all this has to occur at CERN, that we don't have an accelerator here in there in the United States that is doing this leading edge work?
Well, I'm more concerned that in the long run we seem to have lost our enthusiasm for doing basic research in other
right.
fundamental physics form. We should admit that particle physics at the energy frontier is expensive. It's expensive enough that not every country can have their own major accelerator. They should be international efforts, pooling our resources as much as we can. And so I'm not upset that the one that will turn on next year in Switzerland and France will be the leader. I'm upset that we're not doing everything we can to build the one that will come after that. There are excellent plans on the drawing board for doing that. It could plausibly be built in the United States. Mm-hmm. And there's some lip service given to doing it. But as a matter of reality, we're cutting our budget for NASA's astrophysics missions and for the Department of Energy and things like that.
I know.
So it's worth doing because it doesn't lead to a better television or a better transistor radio, but it tells us what the universe is made of. It's the kind of thing that everyone can appreciate, and as a fraction of the money that we spend on things, it's really very, very tiny.
Do you think that some of the reason that in the United States the money is not readily being made available has to do with the fact that the further with this we go, the farther away from the possibility of God at the center of it all we get? This wouldn't be talked about a lot. We're at a break already, so darn it, hold tight, Doctor, and we'll be right back. Dr. Sean Carroll is my guest, and if this is not fascinating stuff, then, well, you're just not listening. That's all there is to it. We'll open phone lines when you get back. You know the portals, so if you want to enter and be prepared to ask a question, now would be a good time. I'm Art Bell.